Thank you for listening to the Gateway to the Rockies podcast from Visit Aurora, from the rafters of the Stanley Marketplace. This is the show dedicated to telling the stories of Aurora, Colorado. Hi there, I'm Dave, Senior Marketing Manager for Visit Aurora. Today, I'm proud to be joined by a distinguished artist, silversmith, entrepreneur, teacher, mentor, Kim Harrell, owner of Kim Harrell Silversmith Jewelry and Design. Did I get all of your titles in?
Yes, and you did a great job saying my name.
I've been researching you, Kim.
Oh, dear.
We have a lot to discuss. First off, can we talk about growing up in Denver? What fueled your early passion for art?
So, yes, I grew up in South Denver and went to Thomas Jefferson High School. Go Spartans.
I'm a tree at myself.
There you go. And I always took art classes. I'm the oldest of three. I never thought of myself as an artist. I just enjoyed art. My father and mother started casually collecting art. So I grew up with art on the walls. My sister, who's the middle child, was always nurtured as the artist in the family. And I loved crafts. I was a brownie. I don't think I ever got to Girl Scouts, so I was a brownie. And I loved doing needlepoint. I loved sewing. I loved doing things with my hands. And my mom was a wonderful craft person, so she would have us do Christmas three kids. What are you gonna do, right? So
keep them busy, yeah.
She found all these, Family Circle magazine, she found all these great crafting things, to use, like clothespins and stuff. And so I think my joy and interest in making things and creating things came probably a lot from my mother. And then she had this amazing jewelry box, when I look back, that I loved to sort out. I had this gift of going through it and untangling all the chains, and I love looking at all the different things and shapes. And I made some earrings. I'd go up to Michael's and get my little pack of earring hooks, and I would make weird earrings. And I'd never thought about being a jeweler, never thought about making jewelry. I didn't know anything about metalsmithing. I didn't have any concept of a career as an artist. So fast forward to college, I went to Colorado College and took ceramic classes, which I love ceramics, but I'm not any good at it. And it wasn't until I moved to England in 1989 that I kind of fell into the jewelry making.
Yeah, when you were at Colorado College, you got a degree in sociology.
I did.
What was the initial plan there? And then what happened in the years, I'm guessing 87 to 94, from going from Colorado to London? What was the impetus of the change?
I met my first husband at Colorado College, who was English. He was in a study abroad program there for a semester, and I met him because I went to go talk to him about the exchange program, because he went to the University of Manchester, which is where I went for a year. I still wasn't making art in any meaningful way. I just didn't really. I enjoyed, it was the 80s. I enjoyed the club scene. I enjoyed meeting people from different parts of the world. And I just was exploring that part of myself, I guess, in a way. And I was always drawn to artistic and creative people. Always have been. The marriage didn't last. And it wasn't until I moved to London. And the plan was to get a master's in social work. And I found out that I couldn't apply in England until I had 2 years of volunteer work. So I started volunteering with the London Lighthouse, which was the patron of that was the former Princess of Wales, Diana. And I was a nightlight, and I trained, and it is an organization that supports people living with HIV and AIDS. And I really enjoyed the work. I met some amazing people that I'm still friends with. But I found out that I couldn't really do a career in that kind of work. I just cared too much. It just broke my heart, some of these people's situations. So I'm like, okay, in the meantime, I found the bead shop and I started buying beads like you do, just like collectors, like pebbles on the sand, except I had to pay for them. And I started collecting them. Like, I had to do something with them. And I was working in an office, and I just started making earrings and selling them to the ladies at work. And then a girlfriend of mine, true story, said, Kim, let me invite all my friends over and let's, have an earring, a jewelry party. I'm like, okay. So it was so rudimentary when I think about it. She still has some of the original pieces. She's so funny. Great supporter. Invited all her crazy friends, and the women proceeded to get pretty drunk. And many of them were in the medical profession. My friend was a pharmacist. And somebody got their ear pierced. Old school, ice cube and needle in the kitchen, because she liked my jewelry so much.
That's hardcore.
That was hardcore. These ladies were hardcore. And so I'm like, huh, and I made a lot of money.
There's something here.
Oh, yeah. So I ended up going to college.
What was your college experience like in the UK? I mean, it's one thing to go to an in-state school. It's another thing to move to another continent and immerse yourself in another culture and a new experience. What was that like? Can you sum it up for me a little bit?
So I started realizing I could make money doing this. I needed to educate myself. So I started taking evening classes at, it'd be like the equivalent of a community college or an adult education place near where I worked. And I worked for the Fulbright Commission at the time, right off of Baker Street and Marylebone High Street, Marylebone Road. So major intersection, all these American tourists looking for Sherlock Holmes' house, which doesn't exist. It was hysterical. Anyway, so I walk there after work and take some classes. And through conversation from the teacher, I found out you could actually get a degree in jewelry. I said, what? I have no idea. So I started doing research and I ended up on what's called a higher national diploma course. It's now called a national vocational qualification. So it was like community college. It was a vocational training course for 2 years. And I had no snobbery around it. I was just like, I just want to learn how to make stuff. And beading was getting boring. So I basically went to an interview and convinced myself. I think they were bemused by me. And they let me come on. And I learned, I was basically being trained to be a job jeweler. And it was pretty hardcore. These teachers, they wore lab coats in the workshops, and they made stuff for the Saudi families that owned half of England, half of London, like gold Quran boxes. Wow. And worked for places like Maupin and Webb and Gerard's and Fortnum and Mason, you know, just high-end jewelry, really high-end stuff. And these were my teachers. So I painstakingly learned some craft skills that I was like, this is torture. But at the time I was there, they were changing the course. And so they introduced an element of design. And I did very well in the course and I left. And then I decided I wanted to continue this education. I wanted to be a better designer. So I transferred onto the degree program. So I actually have a bachelor's in arts with silversmithing jewelry and allied crafts is the full name of it. And that's all I did for 4 years. It's very different from here where, I mean, Colorado College was different anyway. It's the block plan. But you still had required to take, you know, some science and some alternative Western history, non-Western history courses and stuff like that. In the UK, they don't do that. You study what you go there to study for.
It was a de facto boot camp that you put yourself through. So I imagine that instilled you with this incredible confidence when you were done with it, despite it being a harrowing experience. Did you already have that impulse that you were going to become an entrepreneur and come back to the States? How did that connect after you got your degree?
So I graduated in 96, and I had the group of women I studied with, mostly women, there was one man, were from all over the world. Brazil, New Zealand, China, and all ages. Mm-hmm. So, and we were great support for each other. And we were kind of pretty much expected to go on and take a studio and in the UK and in London and throughout the UK at the time. So this is the mid-90s, late 90s. The government supported these things. So there were loads of places, and it's a huge city like New York. So there were great, like huge buildings designed just for creative businesses. And so we all went to our studio spaces. At the time, I can't remember if I got pregnant before I found my studio space. Well, my whole business kind of took off at the same time I started my family. But you just tuck the baby under your arm and get on with it.
That's right.
And I found near where I lived in Wembley at the time, an industrial estate that had spaces to rent. And so I rented a studio space, and most of my other friends were down in the city of London, and I would see them frequently. But I just had my own space, and I, especially with a growing family, and I could just be there when I needed to be there, bring the baby, park her outside the office with the door parked so she could sleep, and I just carry on. So I just did it, and I don't know how I did it. There was a little bit of business training, but I definitely developed a reputation for being very professional and for just being really good at marketing, and I love networking, and the English are, as you may have heard, are a little reserved and a little different. And I just didn't know the rules.
Yep.
So I think that was the biggest thing, is I just didn't know the rules. So I just kind of did what I thought was right. And I think being American, just kind of, brought up in a capitalist society, doing that is kind of natural. So I just threw myself in and had no plans to leave the country until my husband said, Kim, I'd like to move to England. So, move to the United States.
Was it just natural to come back to Colorado, which serendipitously is also a state known for silver mining?
Yes, that's right. My parents were here, yeah. And my sister and brother were here at the time. So we had three young kids under five, and we were at a point where we were living in this very small flat, probably not much bigger than your office space, maybe even smaller. And we had access to a back garden and everything. That was great. But we just thought, what's our next step? What's our next step? And living in London was just crazy. We didn't really want to live outside of London. We made a few tentative moves to maybe go live someplace like Cornwall. But we were like, what are we going to do next? And then my husband said, let's move to America. And I'm like, okay. So Colorado was the natural thing just because we had people here and support. Yep. And with three young kids, we needed someplace to be and help with looking after the kids and that kind of thing. So we came here. And Denver, that was 2003. Denver had just become unaffordable. It was kind of in the beginning of its booming.
Yep.
And my aunt had lived in Aurora her whole time because her husband was based at Lowry Air Force Base. And they settled here in Aurora. And so she said, Kim, come live in Aurora. So she helped me find a place and we ended up living in Aurora. And kids are a product of Aurora Public Schools and never looked back. And I found my people somehow. Took a while because I had young kids. And I started with a gallery first. And when I realized that I couldn't really make my work and do justice to the artists as a gallerist, I shut it down, and a couple other factors contributed to it. And I made a pivot in 2010 and located where I am now. And I really focused on my jewelry making. The kids were getting older. They could be left home alone. I could give it more time. And the business kind of gradually just really took off.
What's the metalsmithing community like here in Colorado?
Well, Colorado's a huge state. So unlike London and even England, I think seven Englands can fit in this state. The distance makes it really, really challenging. And I learned that even more when I was on the board for Colorado Creative Industries, because they're a statewide agency, and I got to know the state. And I, through that work, I saw how many creative industries there were in this state. I was just blown away by the talent we have. And I started to get to know some of the metalsmiths like Jim Cotter and Harold O'Connor, who are old dogs, what I call. Old dogs, they've been in the biz a long time and have international reputations. But other than that, I started learning about like Susan and Jeff Wise, and we have some famous people, Michael Boyd. And then I found about the Colorado Metalsmithing Association, and I was a member. I just paid my dues, got their newsletter in the mail back in the day. And I participated in some other all-member shows, and I never went to a conference in 2018. But it is a really disparate group. It's hobbyists, so people who have had a vibrant career, because as a hobby, if you're actually making what I call proper jewelry, not just stringing beads together, it's expensive. Yep. It's not a cheap hobby. So most of these people have had good careers, and they've been acquiring, they have more equipment than I do, some of these hobbyists. And there are some of them are very good, and some of them even manage to dedicate enough time, they maybe sell on the odd show here and there. There's so many art shows in the state. So we have everybody from hobbyists to professional people who have a brick and mortar store on the street. And it's an amazing group. And I think one of the things when we come together at our conference that you see is that we really do want to help each other. And that isn't always true in these kind of communities. And that is something that when we bring people from all over the country and even the world to our conference, they're like, you guys are so friendly. This is, you're so great. Your vibe is so great. So I think when we come together, we're great. But once we spread apart, it's hard to kind of connect.
You've undersold it a little bit. You're actually the president of the Colorado Metalsmith Association.
I wasn't from the beginning, but I've been since 2020.
What are some of those initiatives that the COMA are a part of that you're particularly proud of?
I think trying to find a way just to bring us together, and it is a challenge. And so it's the conference mainly, and we celebrate and promote the metal arts and all aspects of it. So our conference isn't just, you know, goldsmiths and silversmiths sitting at a bench banging on little pieces of metal. We have had steel sculptors. This year we have Tom Hill, who does wire sculptures. He make, you know, common annealed steel wire, bends them into these beautiful forms. It's just such an amazing thing to be able to do. And he's actually giving a workshop here in Aurora. So, and anybody's welcome to take it. And then we have somebody who does very conceptual artwork, more like sculptural, but with metal, sometimes with precious metal, Mira Mimlich Gray. And she teaches at one of our most established metalsmithing universities in the country, New Platts in New York City, in New York State. So we celebrate all aspects of it. And you always come away inspired from these conferences and knowledge, with more knowledge and connection. So these are people, and I've done this, that maybe you didn't know before, but once they've been there and you've broken bread with them, it's like you can call them up on the phone and go, I had some trouble with some platinum soldering. Called up the guy who's like the platinum king. And I'm like, Kurt, can you help me? And it was really great. So that is a beautiful thing.
I think there's a notion of the hermited artist that stays in their shop, and that's not the case.
They do. And I think that's why the conference gives an excuse to get out and commingle.
It's a creation of a community, though.
Yes.
Where did your sense of stewardship come from? Is that something that was always ingrained, or did you find a community and felt like, I can really be a contributor here?
I'm kind of that person. And I've been told I have leadership qualities.
I can see that.
And I have nurtured them as I've gotten older. I think maybe partly is my dad. He is a pillar in the Denver community, in the law community. His father was a civil rights lawyer, very famous or well-known in the community. And my dad kind of took on that and has done amazing things in his profession of the law. He went on to judge. And he's now retired. He's 80. Oh. But he's still extremely active in the art, in the law community, mentoring people and bringing up the next generation. And I think I have inadvertently kind of emulated that, because I have an apprentice right now who, you know, he's just so talented. And I'm so happy to have him working with me and to encourage him and support him. And I think that's also something the Colorado Metalsmithing Association can do more of. And I would like us to see, it's just really hard to think about how to do that, because we are so spread out. We don't have a physical location. Thank God for Zoom, which kind of saved us. Otherwise, I don't know that we'd be here anymore.
No.
So, you know, it's a challenge to connect people, and it is a desire of mine. And so one of the things that I think I've done was I encouraged moving the conference around the state. So last year we were in Fort Collins, the year before we were in Pueblo, and this year we're in Aurora.
Nice.
And it hasn't been in the metro area, I think, for a really, really long time, if ever, because of the expense.
Right.
But Aurora is still affordable, and I love that I could partner with some other fellow art agencies like Vintage Theater and the People's Building. Having been involved in that arts district area and seeing false starts, back starts, mm-hmm. Oh man, it's still not 100%, but I love Aurora. I think it has a lot to offer, and I love that people maybe don't, because it's like, that's all right, I'll take advantage of it, and you can just maybe join the party at some point.
You've offered a lot yourself. You've taught at the Denver School of the Arts, the Community College of Aurora. You teach at the Arts Students League of Denver. What would you say is the most important piece of guidance that you give to aspiring students?
So with students, often it's they're taking, including at the Community College of Aurora, we only had one level of jewelry. I was it. It's an introduction to making, and there is a joy in making, no matter if you're going to continue doing it or not. I think creating something and finding out what you can do with your fingers and your mind, and you have an idea, and then creating something is a beautiful thing to experience. And so I love seeing the students who just have that aha moment, and it's such a high. It's such a great thing. But I do have a kind of MO, which is I want people to understand what goes into making handmade jewelry. We're so used to this fast, you know, I want it now, I want it yesterday, and I want it cheap.
Right.
And mass production there's a place for it, and it's fine. I mean, I buy that stuff all the time, but the beauty of handmade jewelry, unless you have experienced maybe the making of it or are a collector and talk to artists and they've talked to you about it, I don't think people really appreciate what goes into it. And I want the craft to stay alive.
Yeah.
I don't want it to die. And I love all the new technologies that are available that do give you opportunity. But there's something to be said about hand fabricating something from, I mean, some people go to the extreme where they melt down the metal and they roll it into sheet and wire. I mean, I can do that, and I very rarely do it. But some people, that is all they do. They buy very little pre-made material. They make it all from scratch. And those are what I call those jewelers. They're just, you know, we worship them because it's like, wow. But they're keeping a craft and art alive.
You're right. Technology has influenced so much of our society. I imagine there are machines, like you said, that can mass produce pieces of silver jewelry. But what you've dedicated your life and skill to is this craftsmanship. What's your philosophy on marrying and merging technology with that skillful human craftsmanship? Can the two coexist?
Absolutely. I myself don't, I've dabbled in casting, which enables you, lost wax casting, which enables you to do multiple pieces. The 3D printing thing is amazing. My assistant would 3D print things in the plastic. It's not really plastic, it's some sort of polymer or whatever. and then have it cast in silver, and you can create these amazing textures. So I've seen that kind of thing. And then I've used CAD/CAM with companies where I've taken their existing designs and modified them with their CAD designer, their CAM designer, and then had a piece produced based on that. And for fine jewelry, that works really, really well. For pretty, not, I mean, for intricate, whatever. I choose to hand fabricate. There's still something for me about the work of the hand. And it's not that you aren't polishing that ring and the stone still needs to be set by hand. It's just something to be said. And I've had people come by my stands at art fairs and go, it's nice to see somebody really, you can see that somebody made this jewelry. Yeah. But they also see the fine craftsmanship. So I'm fine jewelry trained, but I've chosen the art jewelry route in that many of my pieces are one off. But the finish on the pieces, the cleanliness of the solder joins and the design aesthetic around it is high-end approach. But affordable.
Could you walk us through the creative process when it comes to designing a new piece? Do you have a vision in mind and then grab the materials? Do you see a raw piece of material and let that speak to you? It's the dreaded what's your process question.
No, I love it because I think about these things a lot because I do talk about my work in a variety of ways. But I have a few areas. Sometimes I do have a vision, but more often than not, I'm inspired by something. So right now, I am in the process of designing a collection that'll debut at the end of April. Well, actually, it won't debut until a show in May, but I have to have it ready by the end of April. And I've decided to go back to Mother Nature. She is a great inspirer. The moon has always featured huge in my work, but I'm using sea pods and back to the plant. There's something about plants. It's in my work more than I even realize. And I'm not a botanist. I don't know where it came from. It may have been, again, back to with my mother. She loved having a garden, and we had a vegetable garden as well as a rock garden. And that joy of seeing these little things grow from a seed is just phenomenal. Yeah, my love of nature definitely comes from my mom. So I start with looking at actual plants, and recently I took some photographs. Photography has always played a feature in my work, and part of that is what I have found when I see something in person, but then if I take a picture of it and look at it again from another medium and I can manipulate the photograph, I start seeing things that I see on steroids. I can like emphasize a line or a shadow or a shape, and that is how I am designing this collection. I've also literally taken something like a tomato and deconstructed it through drawing and just imagination to make, these crazy, I call them seed spoon, and they were all inspired by things in my garden. So I make it sometimes very personal. And so things that I tried to grow maybe didn't grow, and then things that I did grow. And sometimes in the process of making these things, something happens that you didn't expect. I remember when I was making the bean spoon, I was soldering the handle onto the bowl, and the bowl turned black because that's what happens when you heat up silver for the first time, sterling. And I loved how it looked. So I can make it stay black by using chemicals. And I did grow purple beans in my garden. And I just, that wasn't in my design plan, but it happened. And so I love when that happens. And as I get more and more proficient in my work, I'm trying to create those accidents, if you will.
Right.
Bob Ross said something about that.
There are no mistakes, only happy accidents.
Yes, exactly. And I embrace that 110%. One of my best-selling pieces are my rings came from laziness accident. I don't know. And I just, my overlap ring, which is my feature. So I use that whole overlap thing in all my work. I have some basic tenets that I try to approach when I make things.
Creativity in and of itself feels like a feast or famine endeavor. Is that your experience, or do you have a consistent flow of inspiration?
I go to all kinds of art. I don't look to other metalsmiths for inspiration. I am hugely inspired by women artists like Frida Kahlo and Georgia O'Keeffe. I feel a very strong connection to both of them for different reasons. Fine art definitely inspires me. Nature, architecture is another huge inspiration. Of course, living in London,
right?
Blown away. I love taking pictures of buildings and structures. I love industrial spaces like where we're in today. I love that the pipes are exposed and the beams are exposed. Just fantastic lines and forms. I am the freak in Home Depot going down the aisle that I don't know what any of this stuff is, but I just love the shapes and the curves, and I'm just like, what could I make with this?
Yeah.
And I'm attracted in it to anything. Anything could be an inspiration.
You said the art I create is informed by a philosophy of less is more, with an emphasis on shape, line, edges, and texture. How I design and make reflects the process and how I see the world. Can you expand on that a bit more? How does your art speak specifically to your worldview?
So how I see the world literally, and I realize this, I see in 3D. So if I'm giving you a direction and I'm like, David, we're driving along, 2 o'clock, make a right. And in my mind, I see a clock and I'm laying it flat down on the ground, and 2 o'clock is this direction. But I realize in giving exactly those kind of directions, and not everybody sees, people don't see that way. I just thought everybody did. I thought everybody saw in 3D. And so when I see like even a 3D object, I also see things like the edge, or the intersection of sky to a surface, or the bend around a corner and another piece, like I'm thinking of a particular structure when I'm talking about this, and the way the shadow's hitting it, and then maybe something unexpected like a cloud floating overhead, or when I'm looking at the moon, which I do a lot, that's inspired a whole collection. Moon is huge inspiration. You think, Kim, it's just round. And I'm like, I know.
But it's so dynamic. It comes, it's morphing constantly.
Yeah, and then where you see it in what context, like around a building, and then in relation to the stars and the sun, and then eclipse, and it's waxing and waning, and the clouds going across it. There's so many things to see, and I guess I want to take that beauty and put it into an object that you can hold. And it's amazing to me, and it's why I do it, when somebody else connects to you and what you see, because they see something in that too. Now, it's not necessarily exactly what inspired me, but they get the essence. And that, I guess, ultimately is what it comes to, is connecting with people. And the less is more thing is I'm not going to crowd stuff. I want to get to the point. So I call myself a minimalist. And sometimes when I make or design things, I'm like, there's too much going on here.
There does become a point where you go, I guess, beyond the point of no return, where you're like, I should have stopped here. And perhaps I've gone a little bit too far, obviously with the hopes of improving, but that's got to be
a difficult time. You never see that work.
No.
Or it comes away.
How do you go about sourcing your materials, and what are some of the factors that you consider when choosing your material?
So I love silver. It's been affordable. I mean, before the pandemic, it was $11 an ounce, or $14 an ounce. And now, last I looked, it's almost $25. Gold is just ridiculous, but I do like that material. So with silver, and this goes back to my early days before digital cameras, when I would take black and white photographs of models that I would make, and it was all line and shadow and form. Going back to black and white photography, there's just silver is that black to white, and all the colors in between, shades of gray. So, and you can make silver white, and you can make it black. And the only other way to get color on it is by using enamels or other chemicals. But it's harder to make different colors without adding something else. And I think that is why silver is still my favorite. When you start adding color, even gold, it just changes everything, how you see it. And I think color is really, really, some people are beautiful colorists and do wonderful things with enamels. But for me, I'm like, I want to celebrate the metal. And silver for me, the way it catches the shadow like a black and white photograph, when you oxidize it or burnish it, you can bring out those things that I'm trying to bring out in the piece, its line, shape, and form. And so silver is my go-to. And so if I have to design in another material, I have to stop and think about, well, what's going to happen? Because you make something in silver, and then to make it in gold, is it necessarily going to be successful?
Right.
So how I go about making my materials is, choosing my materials, it's very much around, probably I'm going to be using this in silver, and then I have to stop and think, oh, if it's gold, you know, how do I have to amend my design? Or I have to think about it, because there's different qualities to all the metals. So it's about bringing out the qualities of the materials that I choose.
Mixing art and commerce can be tricky. How do you balance staying true to your artistic vision while also meeting the demands of your customer?
That is the big question, isn't it? It's a $64,000 question. And I can't tell you how many times I've attempted to, in the past, not so much anymore, make something because you see a trend. But jumping on the bandwagon, not my style, David. So I just stick to it. I just put my blinders on. I'm like, let's not think about what else everybody else is doing. Just follow your vision and stick to it. And the customers have come. I have an amazing client base. I have fans. I have some crazy collectors. And I don't mean that in the mental illness state.
Right.
They find me.
Yeah.
Where have you been? I've been here 20 years. But I think I'm also at a point in my career where my work is just, I just feel like I'm surfing a wave.
Nice.
The 30 years of making and creating and accumulating ideas and resource material and making mistakes and working with people, it's just exciting. I just hope my hands can keep up.
Are there ever pieces that you're so proud of and you invest so much time and energy into that you say, no, this is for me. I can't bear the idea of someone buying this and removing it from my life.
Oh.
And how do you reconcile that? Because your blood, sweat, and tears, your talent.
They're your babies.
It's all in there.
They're your babies. But I have three babies, so I do know what that is. So they're not babies anymore. They're all grown women.
They'll always be your babies.
Yes. And I told them that. But because I make silverware as well. So it's not just the jewelry. It happens more with the silverware than the jewelry. I like to say I do what I do to the piece. I've done what I wanted to do. And this is why I don't use mass production methods, because just cleaning up a casting is not fun to me. Making something, it's like a blank canvas. You get a sheet of silver and some wire and go make something.
Right.
There's a piece in my studio. There's two pieces in my studio now. This hasn't happened in a really long time, David. And my mom actually really loves a piece I just made. And she's always been supportive. But she wrote me an email, a beautiful email, about this piece that I made because it really touched her. And I don't really have big backstories to many of my pieces, but this piece moved me. And it was kind of inspired during the spring of discontent in 2020 around George Floyd's murder. And I was thinking a lot about my ancestry. And I have African-American slave ancestors. And I was moved to create a piece. It's called Strange Fruit. And it's sitting in my studio. My mom started asking me questions when I saw her in person. And she started asking, is it for sale? I haven't put a price on it yet. And I kind of surprised myself, because usually when I'm done, as I started to say earlier, when I'm done making the piece, all the ideas, the blood, sweat, tears, sometimes there are tears. It is true.
Yeah.
And blood, definitely blood. I'm ready for it to go, because I've done what I wanted to do. And now it's your turn to give the rest of its story. Its history is with the person who takes it away. But this piece, I told my mom, I said, you know, Mom, I want it to stay in my studio for a little bit longer, but it will be for sale. Yeah. And then another piece, I know a collector will snap it out of my hands if she saw it. But I'm like, she's not going to have this one, because I sold one of my favorite pieces to a collector that I made at college. And I'll never see that again. And I sometimes regret, but at the time I needed the money. But I won't do that with this piece.
Many industries have baggage when it comes to the treatment and advancement of women, particularly women of color. Mm-hmm. Did you experience obstacles as a silversmith and jewelry designer in that regard?
As a woman, more than anything else. So in England, I was also an American. Mm-hmm. And the minute I opened my mouth, they know what's coming. And I had a bit of a reputation, I think. Because I just didn't put up with it. When you start working with specific aspects of the trade in the UK, and this was in the late 90s, early noughts, it's male dominated. Except when I left, there was a woman engraver, there was a husband and wife engraving team, and then maybe that was it. It's all men. So like the professional polishers and the platers, the gem dealers, even there, it's very male dominated. But I worked with them, and I felt sometimes they thought they could get away with stuff, but I have a really good eye, and I'd be like, can you please repolish that? Do you not see that? And they look at me, and they don't argue, because it's like, mm-hmm, yeah. And so I do feel like that, especially in the silverware, because in the UK and in Europe in general, silversmithing is non-jewelry. And I think in that particular realm, but I see in the UK, it is dominated by women.
Nice.
And I was part of that group that was coming up. So I'm really excited about that. Here, people aren't interested in silversmithing in terms of objects. I do have some collectors who do it, and it is what I love making. If anything, I have found it until the spring of discontent, I found it very difficult to find other people of color. And another thing that I found very disconcerting in my profession, especially in Colorado, is why with the Colorado Metal Missing Association, there were no there was very little diversity. And I'm talking about, they're not in the women and men, but in an age, it was pretty good, tended towards older, but not ethnically or racially diverse. And I kind of took that on and wanted people who came to the conference to represent that. Not always easy to do, but I've been disappointed that we haven't connected more with the Native American tradition of jewelry makers, because it's vibrant. And for the first time, we're having a person of Native American descent speak at it. He's coming from Santa, and he's like me, he's mixed, but he really and same thing, Native American and Danish. So I love, because I've got Scandinavian in me too, and we had this great conversation about our work, and we see it. We believe in DNA memory. How this stuff comes out in your work is really incredible. So I think there is this separation, and then there's been this expectation I have perceived that once I identify as Black biracial, there's this expectation that my work is going to be referential to the African or the diaspora. That is not how I was trained. Now, that doesn't mean I don't enjoy, love, admire, respect those traditions. I do. And there's a very rich African tradition in gold work and metal work, steel work, before Europeans were working in steel. But I do not feel the need to reference any of my ethnic background in my work. And I don't think any artist should feel like they have to. That doesn't mean I discount it. So I think part of the reason that Strange Fruit Priest was so hard, but I did it in my voice.
Right.
But I wanted to address something of my ancestry, my ancestors, the pain. Because the reality is, David, I would not exist if slavery hadn't existed. And I think that's a really emotional thing. And I'll be honest, I've shied away from kind of incorporating that into my work because it's scary. And I strive to communicate or express things in my work that doesn't matter who you are, where you've come from, you'll still see some beauty in it. Beauty is the ultimate goal here. And if you want to have that conversation, maybe you'll find out something you don't like about the piece, but maybe that will make you love it more. I don't know. That's always the gamble. So I don't like to talk about some of the stuff that happens in my work, but my collectors know and they see it. And so I'm kind of going on record here. Who knows who hear this? But it's a hard thing. And it's still very important for me that my work is beautiful. And obviously the history of lynching in this country is not a beautiful thing by any means. But I was challenged by how I could still make something beautiful that was a memoriam to that history. And I think I succeeded.
It's not an easy dynamic to try to navigate at all.
Mm.
What's it like to host an exhibit of your art? What's the range of emotions?
I've had two solo shows, and I curated a show too that I didn't have work in, but I brought together women like myself who are biracial. So when I had my solo show, and it was all silverware, so no jewelry, I was blown away. I had a collector who used to live here who moved to California who flew out just for that. And she bought a major piece, and she bought a subsequent another piece from it. And the Kirkland acquired some pieces from that, which are in their collection, more permanent collection. So it was an amazing moment, and it blew me away, the support I had. And it's scary because you want to do the best work. And there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears with some of those pieces. Oh, my word. Because you just want everything to be perfect. And nothing ever is, because it's impossible to achieve perfection. And I know everything that's wrong with every little piece I've made, but there isn't anything wrong with them. It's just me. It's an amazing feeling to have people admiring your work and talking about your work and celebrating you. It's very humbling. It's very humbling, and say things about your talent and stuff like that. So I love it and I embrace it, but I also, there's still work to be done. It's not over. It's not over.
Speaking of the work to be done, leader, teacher, artist, entrepreneur, what are some of your goals and aspirations in the coming years?
I'd like to make more of my silverware. It brings out the essence of how I see things in line, shape, and form in a sculptural way. And I always thought I would end up being more of a sculptor. I did take a sculpture class with marble, and that you have to wear too many things. I don't think I can do this. But I would like that aspect to continue and grow in my work and in bolder pieces of jewelry. So I think I'm going bigger and bolder. And interestingly enough, some male clients are helping me get there because they want these big cuffs and bangles. And I love that. And I'm really enjoying. So big, just going big, which is great for my eyesight because that's not so great anymore either.
Kim Harrell, thank you so much for your contribution to our community. Thank you for your stewardship. Thank you for your art. Thank you for your light.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and love meeting you and talking about this today.
Visit Kim Harrell Silversmith and Jewelry Design at 576 B Hanover Way in Aurora. You can also browse now at khsilversmith.com. Follow along on social media at khsilversmith. Thank you for listening to the Gateway to the Rockies podcast. Visit Aurora is the official destination marketing organization for the city of Aurora, Colorado, and acts as the primary liaison between meeting planners and hotel partners. As Aurora's convention and visitors bureau, Visit Aurora's mission is grounded in showcasing Aurora as a premier destination for meetings, business, and leisure travel. Visit Aurora represents more than 75 plus hotel properties with 13,500 plus guest rooms and more than 1 million square feet of meeting space, including Colorado's largest resort, Gaylord Rockies Resort and Convention Center. As Colorado's third largest city, Aurora is located minutes away from Denver International Airport and showcases mountain views, memorable meeting spaces, and 250 plus international eateries that offer a unique experience for each and every visitor. As the gateway to the Rockies, Visit Aurora's role in the local community goes beyond marketing the city as a destination. The Visit Aurora team is here to assist you with your Colorado visit, from facilitating your meeting, event, or convention to helping you discover local flavor and attractions. Go beyond the boardroom in Aurora, Colorado. For more, visit us at visitaurora.com.